This is Andrew Cape.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Aladdin gets a live-action reimagining from Guy Ritchie, while actress Olivia Wilde makes her directorial debut with Booksmart.
You know, when we came up with the idea for the name for this podcast, we were just kind of shooting the shit in the backyard, just playing catch, if I recall. You know, we came up with the Death of Cinema just as like some kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek thing. This was before there were even announced plans for Disney to end up controlling 40% of the box office. And, you know, I imagine when you're pumping out a new movie every week, it seems as if it's very difficult to come up with fresh ideas. Hell, it's tough for anyone to come up with fresh ideas. But this is the reimagining of an animated film from the Disney canon that we've gotten so far this year, and it will not be the last, and I'm already pretty exhausted by it. And so we have Aladdin this time, which is a film that, I mean, I remember seeing in the theater as a kid, and I wasn't a huge fan of it. I mean, I'm not a Disney animation guy in general, so my opinion is already very skewed on this. But there is just something so unnecessary about all of these films, whether or not I've liked them. I think there have been, you know, varying successes, especially with Jon Favreau's Jungle Book, which I quite liked and I thought was done well. I also have a soft spot for Bill Condon's ebullient and, frankly, unabashedly queer and delightful film, Beauty and the Beast. There have been hits or misses, and I think with Aladdin, I kind of fall on the miss side, even though it's not egregiously stupid or bad. And I'm not even a Guy Ritchie fan, even though he kind of gets his, you know, slow-mo into fast motion again, shots that he loves so much. He really kind of takes a backseat here. It doesn't feel like a Guy Ritchie movie in general. There's almost like a Bollywood vibe to it, which is really interesting. But you probably already know this story, so I'm not going to rehash it. I just want to, and it's impossible, absolutely impossible to talk about this film without comparing it directly to the animated film. And the reason stories like this work better as animation as opposed to live action is because there's this weird manic energy and playing around with physics that you can do in animation that look good in animation. But when you try and pull it off in a live action film, it just comes across as tepid and just overly staged. And some of the musical numbers just like kind of feel forced. And there's that raw energy that was there in the first one that is missing here. Even in some of the, you know, the Prince Ali scene, it just comes into the, like this really, you know, we had Robin Williams as the genie in the first film, you know, just kind of like magically shape shifting and everything. And in this one, Will Smith, aptly playing the genie, I might add, comes in and is basically just, you know, singing and doing his thing, and he's just Will Smith, and that's it. And that's fine. I understand that you don't necessarily have to do the same thing, but I also question the wisdom. I know the wisdom is completely money-driven, and you're not going to convince me otherwise. There's absolutely no creative merit in bringing these films to live action, and I don't care what Jon Favreau's going through on the set of The Lion King right now. There is no other reason these movies exist, purely for money, and that's it. So maybe my just blinding rage at the way Disney does business in general is kind of clouding my judgment on this as well. There's a lot going on. So in a purely objective sense, you know, the big story about this was, you know, Will. All right. So first of all, for my money, the big story here, and this is something I will certainly not poo-poo the film for, if anything, I'm happy about it, is that we had the number one movie in the country make a shitload of money with an entirely Arab set cast, with the exception of Will Smith as a genie, obviously an American. But that's nothing but a good thing. This is, you know, a very, very diverse cast. I think the only white guy in the movie was the guy who played the brother in Ingrid Goes West a couple of years ago. And he's funnier in this than he was in that, for whatever it's worth. So I want to focus on Will Smith for a little bit, because that seems to be, you know, that was controversial casting. And Will Smith really, you know, was very nervous about taking this role in the first place. He wanted to put his own stamp on it while still giving respect to the Robin Williams performance. And I think he succeeds. He said he wanted to bring a hip-hop flair to it, which is something that he says we haven't seen in the Disney universe, and not too hard to figure out why that is. But anyway, Will Smith, he has the right energy and the right attitude for this particular iteration of Aladdin, for whatever form that might take. This is very much toned down in terms of the whimsy and the mania and the spectacular visuals. This is I don't want to say grounded, because I mean, you know, it's Aladdin. I mean, how grounded could it actually be with the magic carpet ride and everything? But Will Smith actually gives a little bit of a heart and a little bit of a pulse, and you know, the rapping sequences actually kind of work, and it's funny and goofy, and he's a weird looking character, and he plays it with like just the right amount of tongue-in-cheekiness mixed with sincerity that it works, and I can't explain it any better than that. The rest of the cast, I can't necessarily say. And again, I mean, you're coming off of Scott Weinger's performance, you know, as the original Aladdin, which, I mean, the guy can act his way out of a paper bag. The guy that they got for this film is at least marginally more charismatic. His name is Mina Massad. I'm not 100% sure on the pronunciation. Shame on me for that. But he's, I mean, he does what he can. There's not a hell of a lot to kind of latch on to. You can tell that Guy Ritchie, as a filmmaker, was very much interested in other things aside from the performances. So it kind of is what it is, and we have Naomi Scott as Jasmine. Again, totally fine. Nothing out of the ordinary. They hold their own, and it's just, I guess my biggest complaint regarding the cast would be Marwan Kenzari as Jafar. I don't even know what the hell to make of this villain. He just comes across as more like kind of mealy-mouthed and annoying than he does actually menacing. It just doesn't help the fact that he just looks like kind of, you know, a regular nice guy. There's really not too much there, so maybe that's more on the casting director, or again, maybe it's just on the fact that it's an animation versus live-action discrepancy. I don't know. It's really hard to get into this. Some of the music, I'm not big on the musical numbers to begin with, so those fell flat for me. Andrew's giving me this look right now, but that's fine. The music just wasn't for me back in the day. And so to that end, some of this was a little bit turgid for me to get through. At the end of the day, it's hard to really look at this film objectively just because of so much of the baggage that goes around with it, and the fact that, you know, Disney is basically consuming all of Hollywood all at once. So it's a little bit jarring in that sense. So part of me just kind of went in not wanting to like this and just being like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to be, you know, anti-corporate, blah, 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 or whatever. And, you know, to that end, I mean, who the hell am I saying anti-corporate? I go to a major multiplex twice a week. Who the hell am I? But it's just, there's too much going against it for me to say I liked it. But having said that, I can't imagine too many Disney diehards will be disappointed by it.
Well, I did like it, but I do agree with Ryan on definitely a lot of the points. You know, I'm definitely someone who has questioned the necessity, you know, of these, you know, live action remakes. But I do feel like I come at it from a different perspective from Ryan, because I am a big Disney animation fan. I watched all these classic movies probably like 100 times, you know, growing up, and Aladdin probably the most because it's my favorite, probably classic. You know, there's definitely some debate. There's definitely a few others in there that sort of, you know, vie for the top spot, but I've always had a love for Aladdin, and my love for that comes from what I think are the best collection of songs, top to bottom. I know some people might debate that. Obviously, I think Lion King is pretty close, for sure, if not at the top, you know, but for me, you know, Aladdin, a lot of the joy comes from the songs, and the reason I made a face when you were talking about it is because, not because I thought they did, you know, an amazing job, you know, in live action, but I do think, you know, a lot of my enjoyment of the film comes from my connection to the material, you know, and I really did love seeing some of it in live action, but, you know, and I also disagree about the two leads. I actually thought the two leads were actually quite good, particularly Naomi Scott as Jasmine. She's the one, she gets, like, they wrote an additional, added a musical number in there, you know, for her, and I think she acquits herself nicely. I mean, those that have a connection to the original, it definitely feels like a bit out of place, and it doesn't fit the exact same tone as all the original songs, but I think she gives it her all, and I think she was, you know, one of the film's best parts, because I think she really, you know, I think Jasmine as a character, and I think a lot of people have made this point before, she's one of the better, definitely one of the best Disney princesses, if you want to use that term, because she has a real edge to her, and she has a real sort of thrust in the story. She has a real perspective that's her own, and I think that's some of the joy of it, you know, seeing her in Aladdin interact. But just getting back to the songs just for a bit, like I said, I don't feel like they, like I said, I'm connected to the song, so I'm not going to lie and say when I was watching it in the theater, I did get chills a few times, but a lot of that just comes to the songs, you know. I think I might have mentioned this when we did our review of Bohemian Rhapsody, where it's like, I got chills during that movie, but it wasn't really because of the movie, it was because of the sheer power of the music created by Freddie Mercury and Queen. And I think there's something similar here. I don't think it's great. Like you said, Guy Ritchie doesn't seem to really, I mean, obviously there's a few Guy Ritchie touches in there, but for the most part, if you didn't know, you would never know that Guy Ritchie directed this. And I would have loved to have been in the room where this Guy Ritchie's name, you know, is like, Guy Ritchie's gonna make, you know, Aladdin. And you know, honestly, I can't blame him given, you know, that he's on a run of bombs, you know, in his career. So, you know, all the more power to him that he's able to get a hit. But but it's pretty easy. You know, this was going to be a hit no matter who the filmmaker was, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, Will Smith, you know, like you said, you know, I definitely enjoyed him. You know, I was definitely one of those people when, you know, I initially saw the image and stuff, you know, I don't like to be reactionary, but I couldn't help but look at him and be like, man, I don't know why. I remember the first time they released footage of him or something, I was like, I don't think the footage was ready yet. You know, the special effects weren't exactly fine-tuned. But yeah, in action, I thought he was quite good. I was a bit worried at the beginning, you know, when he's doing the You've Never Had a Friend Like Me. And there was just something about the way, you know, like I said, I think the music is powerful on its own. But some of the presentation of some of the musical numbers isn't as interesting. And I think the biggest culprit of that is probably one of the most iconic Aladdin songs, A Whole New World, where it's like, you know, it happens and, you know, in the animated film, it's like such an iconic moment and it has that power. And like I said, while I enjoyed the two leads, I just felt like that sequence didn't have the power that it did in animation. And, you know, we can get into the climactic scene in the film, which is just sort of a waste. And, you know, I've heard people criticize the climax of the original Aladdin live action animated where Jafar turns into the snake and all this stuff, but it at least has some visual panache to it and it really works well in animation. Here it's just an evil Iago chasing them like through the city for like a minute and then it's over and resolved. It just felt like really just sort of cheap. But like I said, I did enjoy the film just because it was so odd seeing this, you know, story that I was connected to and had seen many times as a child, you know, up there on screen. And like I said, I enjoyed the two leads. I thought they were enjoyable, but much like Ryan referred to with Marwan Kenzari as Jafar, I definitely agree with you on that point. You know, I think Jafar is one of those iconic Disney villains, and he works so much better because he's very snake-like, you know, in the original, and they really utilize that. Obviously, as I just said, he literally turns into a snake at one point, and a lot of the joy of the original comes from the interactions between him and his parody Iago, who's basically just, you know, just there here, you know, in the film. I do admire some of the steps that they took clearly to have better, you know, representation and better representation of the culture. There are clearly some tweaks, you know, and obviously in the original Aladdin animated film, although, like I said, it's one of my favorites and I love it, there are certainly a few elements here and there and touches that they clearly upgraded for the modern era here, and I think it's all the better for it. You know, and but like I said, you know, I enjoyed it overall, but I don't think it's particularly good or great. I would say I liked it and enjoyed it, but it's not like a great piece of cinema, you know, and I think most people who are connected to Aladdin will really enjoy this film and, you know, won't really see a lot of these, you know, flaws or seams on the surface, you know, but, you know, getting back to the necessity of these things, I admitted that I really enjoyed Beauty and the Beast. I thought it had that energy to it and it had, you know, there was definitely some of that energy. Like I said, the energy popped up here and there in Aladdin, but it was never consistent. And I think that was the biggest issue. Some of the sequences I thought really worked in live action, where others, you know, didn't quite. You know, and I was, like I was saying, you know, I pretty much prefer, you know, all of the musical numbers in the original, you know, animated. My favorite being One Jump Ahead, which is always, you know, that occurs Aladdin's sort of big opening number, which I've always been connected to in a big way. It's safe to say it does not have the same energy or excitement in live action. But like I said, I thought they did, you know, an okay job, but the translation, you know, just wasn't there. And I think some of these things just work better, you know, on that animation level. But, you know, I touched on, you know, an element that they added as the musical number with Jasmine. I wanted to touch on just one other real simple thing that they added, which was that, which they added to the Genie character, which was that slight love subplot or whatever, which I actually liked. I thought that was a nice touch with Nassim Pedran of SNL fame. You know, I thought that was a really nice touch. It was unexpected. And I thought it just added some emotional connective tissue to Will Smith's Genie. And I thought that worked. But essentially, you know, overall, I liked the film, you know, but I wouldn't say, you know, it's great or over the moon, but I think most people who like the Disney animated films and like Aladdin will enjoy this film for sure.
You know, it's just getting, I keep trying to rack my brain about just where this whole project is going. I mean, there are only so many Disney animated movies that they can put out. And I know, you know, for the most part, they do a good job of at least marketing and making their more original fare, like Frozen into, oh Jesus, we're getting a Frozen live action, aren't we? Never mind. I think I just answered my own question. No, at the end of the day, it's hard to say because I just want to keep on coming back to the validity of the existence of these movies in the first place. And, you know, we're in this era where it's like, you know, back in the day, the summer movie season was like this big thing. You get like maybe five or six huge action CGI tent poles a year. And now We're basically getting one a week from every week since January. And it's just exhausting. But as Disney continues to swallow up the entirety of the box office, I just don't want it. Like, I fear getting to the point of this oversaturation and this homogenized idea of Hollywood that's even worse than it is now. I mean, Hollywood is completely devoid of original ideas. And it's not to say, like, I don't want to be one of those, like, oh, you know, they don't make them like they used to kind of argument. Because I think that there is a lot of creativity that you can mine within these projects if you hire the right filmmaker and if you, as a studio, back off. But it is very clear, like we say, you know, this doesn't even feel like a Guy Ritchie movie. This is very clearly studio hands all over this thing, and it's just really off-putting. And at the end of the day, if they are going to continue to do these, I just wish that they would put a little more faith in their filmmakers, because if I have to suffer through these, then damn it, I just want them to be just a little tiny bit more interesting.
Actually, you know what's interesting? You bring up an interesting point there, because I want to connect this to a film that I just saw just recently that I completely wiped from my mind, which was Tim Burton's live-action, you know, Dumbo remake, which, you know, like I said, it wasn't great at all, but that is definitely one of the few, I would say, live-action remakes that I've seen from Disney that really does clearly come from the filmmaker's perspective and doesn't feel like a completely, you know, processed thing. And I think you could see why that's the case, because the original animated Dumbo is such a depressing, you know, sad movie, so they were like, oh, well, Tim Burton can do this, no problem, we can let him off the leash. And you could see, you know, while the film wasn't a complete success, as I said, you know, there was clearly that creativity there. Here, you know, like you said, Guy Ritchie is sort of more anonymous. There is some creativity there, but a lot of that stems from the original, you know, source material. Now, I do think, you know, obviously with Lion King coming up here in just, you know, a few short weeks, whenever it's coming out, I know soon, you know, it should be interesting. You know, I've talked about in the past my worries about the Uncanny Valley, and I definitely did not enjoy Jon Favreau's Jungle Book as much as a lot of other people did. While I thought the story was connective, there is something about just these animals, you know, in CGI talking, I just don't think it looks right. It's one of those things where I just have a hard time connecting to it. Now, I feel like The Lion King is something that's incredibly hard to screw up. It's such a powerful story in its own right, and the cast is incredible, so obviously we'll see what happens. But, you know, I think Jon Favreau clearly has that passion there, and I wanted to bring it back to this because I know you mentioned this earlier, and I couldn't help but laugh, but you mentioned, yeah, what is Jon Favreau doing on the set of The Lion King? And I was like, set, with quotes. I was like, oh, that's a really interesting way to put it. And it's funny because I saw like a headline recently. I think Jon Favreau did an interview and I saw the headline. It was like, even Jon Favreau is confused whether his Lion King is actually animated, because technically, although this is a live action remake of Lion King, it's technically not live action because it's all animation. Whereas, you know, Aladdin is clearly, you know, live action. There's a clear difference. So I don't know. It gets really complicated down this. But safe to say, you know, like I said, I don't think there's, you know, obviously, you know, the need to make these movies comes from, you know, greed. It is. It's as simple as that. They know there's a built-in audience. They know there's money to be made and will make them. It's just sort of, you know, it would definitely be more beneficial if they let some of these filmmakers really get creative with it. But this is Disney we're talking about and everything is sacred. So it's probably wishful thinking at best. But I guess on that note, we can transition into the second film, which I saw, Ryan was unfortunately unable to see, but man, I don't even know where to begin with this one. But this is a film, Booksmart, you know, the directorial debut of actress Olivia Wilde. And man, this film is like really unique. You know, I've talked in the past about my love for these coming-of-age high school stories. I just connect to them on such a deep level. And safe to say, you know, I definitely connected to Booksmart. Although I will say, although it works within this genre, I honestly don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. And I'm going to do my best to explain, you know, how that is. But I don't think you can really understand that unless you see the movie. You know, I think you even mentioned manic energy, you know, earlier in this podcast. And those are the terms I would use to exactly describe this film. It has a manic energy. And I think a lot of people, it might take some warming up to get into the film because it's very abrasive, bold, and in your face, you know, as it starts, you know, as it centers around essentially the two leads played by two stellar performances from Caitlin Dever, who's been doing great work from such a young age. I remember from popping up on Justified, and she's really great in this, as well as, you know, who I think is going to be a massive star in Beanie Feldstein, who really, you know, had a great role in Lady Bird, and man, is she amazing in this role. For those of you that don't know, I had my mind blown recently when I found out about this, as she's the younger sister of Jonah Hill, which I just found out recently. I was like, that makes too much sense, but I just think they literally are a dream team in this film, and they really are the thrust of the story. Is essentially they're these two students who, you know, have focused on their studies, much like I did, you know, when I was a student. You know, they were only focused on their studies, and they didn't take the time to become friends with other people or get in relationships or party it up or stuff. But essentially, this takes place essentially over the course of one day, I guess, essentially is how it takes place. And, you know, essentially it's nearing the end of the school year and they're off going to graduate and going off to college. And it's at this point when they learn from all these other people who have, you know, been just, you know, having sex, partying it up, etc., that all these people who they thought didn't put any effort in are all going to amazing colleges like Harvard and Cornell. And it's almost verges on the point of parody, but that's the fun of the movie, is it really, like, it has this tongue-in-cheek approach, but you still buy into it. The world just has this energy. It's filled with some really wild, crazy characters. The characters in this movie, I've never seen any, you know, high school characters quite like some of them, but that's the appeal of the film. They're really unique. Like I said, I feel like this film just has a really unique approach to it. But essentially, we follow Deaver and Feldstein along, you know, on this journey, and essentially, obviously, they're going to a big party, but essentially, it's one of these things where they're meant to go to this big party, and they sort of make stops all along the way, and crazy things happen. But, you know, like I said, I think Deaver and Feldstein, they really have this great chemistry, and their friendship really comes through in a strong way. And they also have, you know, unique personalities of their own, where Deaver is more of the, you know, hesitant, awkward, and shy person. You know, she's sort of coming into her own sexuality. She's sort of, you know, she's a lesbian, and she's trying to, you know, work up the courage, you know, to, you know, talk to this girl who she's always had a crush on. Whereas Beanie Feldstein is trying to work up the courage to talk to this guy that she's always had a crush on. So it has this really fun dynamic. But, you know, Beanie Feldstein is playing a character who, unlike the more awkward, shy of her friend, she's definitely more in your face. And that's, I think, you know, I think people, you know, the way the movie starts, I think sometimes it takes a few minutes to really just get into it, because it's just like so in your face right from the get-go that it's like, all right, this is this kind of movie. It has this energy, and you just kind of have to go with it. And if you don't, you know, wind up going with it at a certain point, I'll be surprised, because I think it's just really just enjoyable and really funny. And like I said, a unique experience, whereas it's working, you know, within this genre with well-worn tropes, it's doing it and going about it in a different way, although it is just one of these one crazy night, you know, type of films. I do have to point out one particular supporting actress who completely blew me away in this, and that is Billie Lourd, who might be better known as Carrie Fisher's daughter. And she plays this character, like I was saying, you know, this world is full with really unique characters. She plays this crazy character, Gigi, who every step of the way where Feldstein and Deaver are going, you know, she pops up and she's doing something insane. We're never quite exactly sure what's going on with her character. She's doing insane things, taking drugs, God knows what she's doing. And there's also some really creative sequences in the film that sort of, you know, I think people's mileage, you know, may vary, you know, when the film definitely takes some creative liberties. And I think that sort of adds to the uniqueness of the experience. What I also really like about the film is that, you know, and I've, you know, I don't know, I don't want to go down this path too much, but I've always been a proponent that I think people are too uptight, you know, or a bit, you know, just sort of wary of sex, you know, in movies. And I think this film, you know, explores it in that perfect way, you know, much like with Blockers, that I thought was a really refreshing and joy to see, you know, these female characters be really brash and raunchy. The same is the case here, and I would say even more so to an extent at certain points. And I think they're not afraid to explore that and also explore it in different ways. I think it's really impactful, even on an emotional level, the way they handle, you know, Deaver and Feldstein's friendship and the way they, you know, their night, you know, unfolds with some of these relationships and the people they're pursuing and how that plays out. I thought they really handled it, you know, in a really mannered, but really, just really enjoyable way. It's both emotionally impactful and just entertaining and fun to watch. Always, and I think it's a credit to the two leads in particular, but also Olivia Wilde, because, you know, I mean, you know, usually in a directorial debut, you can see the seams, and I could definitely see that there's a lot of ideas coming from Wilde burgeoning at the surface, but somehow I think it just works, you know, whereas you know, the film moves at a quick pace. It's edited, you know, very well. And I just feel like it just, it has that, you know, while you could certainly point out a few things like, oh, maybe that doesn't work quite as much as the other stuff in the movie. I think there's always that energy there that carries you through. And I think a lot of that is down to the two leads and just Wyld's command on the story. And clearly, you know, she's passionate about these characters and feels connected to them. So we, the audience, are connected to them as well. There's also some really fun side plots that I know Ryan, I wish Ryan saw this, because there's some really fun people that pop up and some side plots that I thought was really fun. One of the more underrated people who was on SNL in the past, God knows what, Mike O'Brien pops up in a role that, I was not expecting it to go the direction it did, but it's just sort of more of a funny aside. He doesn't play a major role in it, but there's a great payoff to it that I thought was really fun. Jason Sudeikis pops up, who has been in a longtime relationship with Olivia Wilde, so that makes sense. And I also think he's utilized well. Jessica Williams plays a teacher at the high school, and she has a fun sort of side storyline as well. But it's all these people, like not just high schoolers, but of different ages. I know Lisa Kudrow and Will Forte play Caitlin Dever's parents, and there's a really fun interaction with them, although they play sort of a minor role. But it's just full to the brim. You know, the film is brimming with personality. And like I said, that manic energy. And I think, like I said, I haven't really experienced that manic energy quite like this in quite some time in the movie theater. And I just thought it was, you know, really enjoyable, really fun characters, a really fun story, but just really unique for this type of film. And I think it's definitely worth really going out there and seeking this out, because I think a lot of people will really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, this has been kind of an unfortunate year for me in terms of timing and just trying to get to the theater when I can and et cetera, et cetera. But one thing that I was able to watch, and this is, we're going to turn a little bit to the TV realm, although there is a connection here, was the bringing to television. I don't even want to call it an adaptation per se, because it's almost a continuation of the same universe of Taika Waititi's What We Do in the Shadows, which has been airing on FX. Just finished up last week. And I got to say, I honestly think it works a lot better than the movie. Sometimes that short truncated 20 to 25 minute span that running time that an episode is given tends to work better than a joke that can kind of get dragged out. And as much as I enjoyed the first film, I think it did get a little bit long in the tooth, which is problematic considering it's only about 90 something minutes. And I'm a huge Taika Waititi fan. I think Hunt for the Wilder People is a masterpiece. Thor Ragnarok is a lot of fun. And even going back to Eagle versus Shark was fun as well. But I think this is really the Jemaine Clement show. He wrote most of the episodes and he directed quite a few as well. Taika Waititi's name does pop up on the credits here and there as well. But it centers on a completely new group of vampires that were not in the first film. It takes place in Staten Island as opposed to Wellington, New Zealand. But we're focused on the casting in this was just absolutely impeccable. They could not have done a better job. Particularly Kayvon Novak, who... I hesitate to say most people would remember him from the film Four Lions, because I don't think too many people actually saw Four Lions. Here he plays kind of like the, I don't even want to say that, like, you know, because in the beginning you're trying to compare him to the characters from the original film, but they really are their own thing. And I think that's a credit to them wanting to take it in a different direction while still staying true to that same tone. And it just, you know, it's a day-to-day thing. This is a sitcom. This is basically The Office with funnier jokes with vampires. Matt Berry in there as well, from a British comedian, probably best known for The Mighty Boosh, that it's aired on Adult Swim here in the United States. And what's her name? Natasha Demetriou is the female vampire in this instance, and she's a British comedian as well. This was my first experience with her. All three of them are hilarious. They have a perfect deadpan delivery. And for those of you who are kind of put off by the trailers, I assure you that as the series wears on and we get to know these characters a lot better. I mean, right from the get-go, it's very funny, but it ends up being hysterical by the end. And they really do that great job of making sure these vampires interact with the modern world in a way that doesn't necessarily, like, they don't necessarily beat you over the head with the fish out of water stuff to the extent that these vampires are completely ignorant of the modern world, but they are more so stuck in their own ways and they refuse to pander to what they are experiencing. But just simple things like, you know, going out clubbing, going to the town council meeting, some things that, you know, applying for citizenship. ship, because obviously they're all from another country. They're just these episodes that that just stick with you. They stand on their own. I think you could probably jump in at any one episode and still laugh your ass off. But it really, there are some storylines that are running through that are planted in the pilot and that kind of have a nice little send-off in the last couple of episodes. But really, the joy of the show is the one-liners. They are absolutely hilarious. It is just whip-smart funny. I don't want to give away any of the jokes because I do think it is worth watching. It's an easy watch, too. It's not something you have to invest a lot of time in. 10 episodes in and out really quick. There are a lot of great cameos that Beanie Feldstein actually shows up in a few episodes as a virgin that was to be sacrificed, but that kind of gets turned on its head. Vanessa Bayer, also of SNL fame, shows up in a couple episodes, and they just kind of expand the mythology of the vampires themselves. There's also an energy-sucking vampire who is basically that boring guy in your office who just wants to talk your ear off about anything. It's played by an actor named Mark Prosk. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but it really just puts a new spin on something that could have been just like very tepid. There are just so many great sequences and one-liners, and I'm really kind of doing it a disservice by describing it in this way, because the joy in seeing some of these surprises, particularly later on, and some of the more fun cameos that do show up later and that just like completely take you by surprise. And I don't even know how they got some of these actors into it, but this is A-list material all the way. And kudos to FX for having so many great connections in Hollywood and being able to rope in this much talent. So I know that there's already been greenlit for season 2, but really it'll probably be on Hulu pretty soon. So, you know, honestly, if you got a lazy Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, you owe it to yourself to check it out. But I do recommend you watch the original movie first, just so you understand the ebbs and flows of the humor that you're getting into.
Yeah, I was definitely a big fan, you know, of the original movie and Taika Waititi in general, so I'll definitely add it to the list, although I will admit there's no guarantee I'm ever going to get to it, because as everyone knows, I think there's almost too much to watch at this point. I just started watching Westworld or whatever, because I just needed something else to watch, and man, is it good? It's very intriguing, and so I'm interested to see how that goes, but, you know, I'll definitely add What We Do in the Shadows to the list. But I guess with that in mind, we can turn our attention to next week, where we'll be talking about Godzilla King of the Monsters, which we both already saw, and I know we both already have some interesting thoughts on it, which we'll be getting to. And we're also going to be checking out Rocket Man, and hopefully there'll be a quick turnaround on this episode, because we've already got Godzilla in the cans, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how Rocket Man came across on the big screen.
And I know we're going to get into this more next week, but putting you on the spot, what's your favorite Elton John song?
That's too difficult a question to just put me on the spot. And Ryan, I like how Ryan likes to do this, and it's like, this doesn't really add anything to the podcast other than makes me look like a fool. But I mean, come on, Tiny Dancer, Benny and the Jets, I always have a soft spot for, because as a kid I used to, because I hated the Jets, and I used to sing Vinny and the Jets for Vinny Testaverde and the Jets. But you know, you can't go wrong. It's Elton John. I mean, come on. The guy's amazing.
Don't let the sun go down on me. Andrew, I'm so sorry I keep putting you on the spot. It's just a fun thing I like to do sometimes. But we will dive far more into the discography of Elton John, as well as the wisdom of musical biopics, although apparently this one's much better than the Bohemian Rhapsody. So everything's coming up roses as far as I'm concerned. But as always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.